For those of you that I have not had the opportunity to meet, my name is Ed Barron. I have the privilege and pleasure to preach every now and then. This is my home church. But to come and bring the word every now and again, I call it a privilege and an honor because I know what it is for a senior pastor to have someone come in his absence and be able to break the bread of life with the family. And so it's an honor to be able to do that. I spend most of my time at APU, where I am on staff there. I oversee our Student Center for Reconciliation and Diversity. So I do that kind of work. I also teach in the leadership department, leadership minor. We just came off the weekend in the fall. And so what that usually means is that your favorite team played yesterday, right? And your favorite team lost, and you're coming to church feeling a little humble. Or your favorite team won, and you're coming to church excited, right? Well, my favorite team won yesterday. Now, what may surprise you, thank you, what may surprise you is that my favorite team is the La Mirada Soccer Association under 10 squad that won the championship yesterday. And the reason that that's important is that my grandson plays on the team and my son coaches the team. It gets even better because it's actually a back-to-back because they won the championship last, not the exact same team, but my son was a coach and my grandson was on the team. Are you getting a theme here? Huh? What makes it even more interesting is my son never played a lick of soccer in his life, but somehow he figured out how to coach it, and he's done a fantastic job, and so I'm feeling pretty good this morning. How about you? Plus the fact that USC did win yesterday, but that's another message, so we'll leave that alone for now. I want to share with you this morning the idea that song is very, very inspiring because it talks about this bridge and the water is troubled. And over the last, or last week, Pastor Albert started a series on the life of a disciple. And he looked at this idea of community. Remember the elaborate table that was up here, and then the dynamics that happen, the exchange that happens in community, the support that happens in the community. So the disciple is a part of a bigger whole. And so we're going to continue that this morning. But we're going to talk about the idea of community as it relates to one of our distinctives as a church. As a church, you know, you just heard Pastor Michael say that we are intergenerational, we are multi-ethnic, and we are gospel-centered. We repeat that every Sunday, not just to be monotonous, not just to be repetitive, but we do that because we want to instill this idea of identity into everyone that comes that they know exactly who we are. You see, the reality is none of you would ever dare introduce yourself using another name. Well, wait a minute. I know that some of y'all used to do that back in the day. And some of you may still have cause to do that right now. But for the most part, we would not introduce ourselves as somebody else because we are proud of who we are. We want others to know who we are. And when we come into the fullness of our identity, it's even more and more important for us to know who we are. So we introduce ourselves each and every time we gather as this intergenerational, multi-ethnic, gospel-centered fellowship so that there is no doubt who we are. Sandwiched in between those three distinctives is this idea of being a multi-ethnic church. And so we're going to unpack what that means in part this morning as it relates to being a community. So we're going to be talking about what does it mean to be a multi-ethnic community. The passage I want to start us off with this morning is found in 2 Corinthians chapter 8, verse 14. So if you can find 2 Corinthians 8, 14, it's a short passage, but I believe it's a very dynamic passage with respect to getting us to where we want to go this morning. So 2 Corinthians chapter 8, verse 14, and it says this. This is Paul speaking to the church at Corinth. It says that at this present time, your abundance being a supply for their need, so that their abundance also may become a supply for your need, that there may be equality. Let's pray as we get started this morning. Father, we thank you and praise you for the gift of your word. We thank you, Father, for the freedom that we have to come into a place like this and worship, lifting up your name, hearing from you, Father, for the purpose of being eternally changed. Lord, may you be pleased in what you see and what you hear this morning, God, the response of your saints to the word of God. And we'll be careful when it's all said and done to give you all the praise and all the glory. We pray these things in the matchless name of King Jesus. Amen. So the picture that Paul paints here is he's saying that there is abundance and there is lack. There is abundance and there is lack. But the abundance supplies the need of those in need. And those in need, they have an abundance that supplies likewise. And so you get this idea of this two-way street going over a bridge, going over a chasm. A bridge going over water that may be troubled. It may be troubled because the bridge always spans a divide. It connects a divide. But it's not our abundance that creates the divide. Abundance never creates the divide. What creates the divide is lack. See, we have the have-nots only because we have the haves. Right? We have the non-believer only because we have the believer. And see, if we're not careful as Christians, and we use that term non-believer, if we're not careful, it otherizes people. In other words, we call non-believers almost like they are the enemy. I know I started fast this morning, but it's important that we make these points. That we look to those that aren't people of faith almost, if we're not careful, with a little bit of disdain. You see, so the bridge that's needed to create and to connect that relationship is not built on abundance. It's built on lack. That someone needs what you have, and guess what? You need what somebody else has. None of us has everything we need. But all of us have something that we can give. So let me preface this morning as I talk about abundance and lack, because our framework will probably immediately go to this idea of material stuff, right? And all that, although that's a part of it, it's not all of it. In fact, it probably isn't even the most significant thing. Because there are some among us this morning that have an abundance of compassion, that have an abundance of patience, that has an abundance of caring, and there are others among us that are in desperate need of those things. And what Paul is saying, in order to get to this idea of equality, where there's some kind of restorative state to what God designed to begin with, you need to have this reciprocation of abundance meeting lack. So we get the picture of the bridge that spans this chasm, that spans this river, that spans this divide. And I submit to you this morning that the divide has to do more with lack than it has to do with an abundance. See, it's in this exchange that authentic community is created. It's in this recognition of this exchange that the real community that we're looking for, whether it's the church community, the community in which you live, in which you work, see, authentic community is created only when we have an opportunity to create this exchange. But unless there's a bridge, there's not an opportunity to have that exchange. You see, the goal of humanity is not to reach independence. I know that's our tendency, is to try to become independent. I want to be financially free, which that means is financially independent. You know, I don't want to have to need anything. I don't want to have to ask anyone for anything. That is not the goal of life. But the goal of life is to recognize that we are interdependent. So it's not to become independent, but to recognize that we are interdependent, that there is someone in our sphere of influence that we need from, and they need from us too. You see, I was created, I was born, I am incomplete. And I need you. But the reality is you need me too. In the midst of this dynamic of abundance and lack, it's interesting to me that God chose to make us different in a variety of ways. We're different from a gender perspective. We're different looking in terms of our physical characteristics, but we're also, and what I want to focus on this morning is we are ethnically different. We are ethnically different. The word ethnic means, in the Greek, it's the word ethnos. It speaks to nations. And so our nation of origin, even though you may not be totally in touch with that, or at this point in our history, we're kind of a sort of a mixed bag, but we have a nation of origin that pretty much determines, for the most part, how we look physically, right? And we're different. So why don't y'all look at each other for a minute, just to see how different you are. Just look at the person next. Just look around. There's some different looking people up in here, right? But here's the significance as we talk about bridging and being bridge builders. Here's the key that you need to understand as we go forward this morning is sameness. Brings about this idea of simplicity. Sameness is safe. But difference is difficult. Sameness is safe. But difference is difficult. See, we're at the holiday seasons right now, and we have Thanksgiving coming up, and then we have Christmas coming right on the heels of that. In fact, I think we've just blown past Thanksgiving. I think it's just a formality, right? We went from Halloween, and we're always talking about Christmas, right? But for a lot of us, we'll gather with family and friends over both of these holidays. And undoubtedly, invariably, there's going to be people in that gathering that you're not looking forward to seeing. Right? For a variety of reasons. But what we will do is we will, for that designated time, we will tolerate them. For that designated time, we will choose to be in the building with them, but we don't have to say nothing to them, right? For that designated time, for the sake of the matriarch or patriarch, and the reason that we gather, we will tolerate the ones that are, for whatever reason, different from us. And as soon as that occasion, that time is done, we'll go our separate way. And it could be as we were getting ready to gather, we are hoping that maybe they don't show up. Maybe they get sick. Or they have a crash. Not a bad crash, just enough to slow them down. Right? Just enough to slow them down. Right? But we get there, we realize that they are there. And so we go through the motions, but there is no connection because there's been a breach that needs a bridge, but the bridge is not there. And so when that time is over, we go back to doing life with those that are more similar to us and not different from us. And fellowship, I hope that that description does not apply to our church. That on that occasion when we choose to gather, and because we find ourselves in the midst of people that are different from us, that for the sake of the patriarch and for the sake of the occasion, we put up with each other. But then as soon as the occasion is over, we go back and we find ourselves in the midst of those that are similar and same and safe. And we don't gather with those that are different until the occasion calls for it for the sake of the patriarch. And we come back together. You see, we have to talk about this idea of what it means to be a multi-ethnic community. We have to wrestle with this idea of being different. Someone just told me during the break, it's our similarities that bring us together, but it's our differences that teach us. I'm going to give him credit that one time, but next time I say it, I'm going to say, like I've always said. Right? But I'm going to give him credit this time. Right? It's our similarities that bring us together, but it's our differences that teach us. Grant me a little liberty right now. I want to invite you all to do something that will make a point that will be a good framework for the rest of the message this morning. If you wouldn't mind, take your right hand and your index finger, point it towards the ceiling, but I want you to get it up above your head. Some of the students that are in the room have seen me do this before, but bear with me. Now, I want you to imagine that your finger is pointing at a clock, and your finger is pointing at the 12, because I want you to rotate clockwise, so I want you to have a frame of reference. So you're on the 12, and you're going to go clockwise, so 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. You ready? Get it going clockwise. Get it going real good. Rotate it clockwise. Now, I want you to slowly bring your finger down below your chin and keep looking at it. Which way is it turning? Huh? All right, let's try it again. Because Y'all already said whoops. Let's try it one more time, okay? All right, hold on. Hold on. I know y'all want to work it out. Everybody with me, you want to point? We're on the 12, right? And then we're going to rotate clockwise. So 1, 2, 3. Ready, go. Now, slowly bring it down. And which way is it going? Counterclockwise? Counterclockwise? Come on now. I don't have that long to preach now. Y'all got to get this. It's going counterclockwise, isn't it? You can stop doing it. Y'all still trying to work it out. What? So when you brought it down below you, she's still trying to work it out. Look at it. She's still, I don't know what just happened. Okay, so something changed. What changed? Yeah, just the way you chose to look at it. You literally looked at the exact same thing a different way, and it appeared the exact opposite of what you thought. It's our differences that teach us. She's still working it out. I'm not sure. Maybe I did it wrong. Let me try it again. You looked at the very same thing. Isn't that amazing? You looked at the very same thing a different way and saw something totally different. It's our sameness, our similarities that bring us together. Those whose worlds turn in a clockwise fashion tend to gravitate with each other. I'm making this kind of simple. But it's our differences that teach us. Why did it change? It changed because we chose to look at it. When God created us different on purpose, He did that because He knew that we would have abundance and lack. No one's perpetually filled with abundance, and we all have need, and we all have lack. And if we can allow ourselves to view a situation from a different perspective, we may just find that our abundance being filled in an unexpected way. To be in multi-ethnic, multi-ethnos with all of our cultural expressions, we are bound to encounter folks that see the world turning differently than the world that we think, or the way that we think the world turns. But imagine with me this morning that God is doing that on purpose to change the perspective of His people, that we might have a fuller vision of Him. Because if I read my Bible correctly, it says that we are created in the image of God. So all of our different perspectives, we are created in the image of God. All of our different expressions and our colors and our vibrancy, we are created in the image of God. So there's something in me of God that you need to understand, and there's something I need to understand about a God that's resident in you. So what would it look like? What would it look like in a community like Fellowship Monrovia to be purposeful about looking and engaging and making room, really making room for those different perspectives? There's a quote from Dr. Martin Luther King has to do with his desire for this, what he called the beloved community. And I want to read that quote to you and then spring into a little bit of a personal testimony and then equip us in terms of what it means to be bridge builders, because bridges don't get built by themselves. Right? There needs to be somebody that puts their hand to the work to build the bridges, and we're going to do that this morning in terms of developing bridge builders. But the quote goes like this. This is Dr. Martin Luther King. He says, "Our goal..." Speaking of all of those that were committed to this work of unity and diversity through the civil rights movement, he said, "Our goal is to create a beloved community, and that this will require a qualitative change in our souls as well as a quantitative change in our lives." A qualitative change in our souls and a quantitative change in our lives. And so this idea of qualitative speaks to the quality of, the richness of, the depth of, the sincerity of our very souls. It speaks to something transformational that happens that only God Himself can author. And then he says, a quantitative change in our lives. So there needs to be more than just talk. That there needs to be action. There's going to be expression of this community that's lived out by the people of God. And there's a so what because of the, or there's a so what behind that idea of people living together in real community. And I submit to you this morning that the world is dying to see this work because everybody says that it can't. Not just people coming together, but people choosing to be together. But I can't help but read or quote or think about Dr. Martin Luther King and remember the deep impact that he continues to have on my life. For years, I couldn't read about Dr. King, or I couldn't even look at a picture of Dr. King because there was so much pain behind it. And the reason is Dr. King is connected with what I call the day that I discovered I was black. Now, that's not because we didn't have any mirrors in our house or anything. I knew what the color of my skin was. But there was a day that I discovered what it meant to me as a young boy to be black. It was April 5th, 1968. Now, some of you will know that on April 4th, 1968, Dr. Martin Luther King was assassinated. It would be the next day because back then we didn't have a 24-hour news cycle. There wasn't CNN or there wasn't Fox News, and there wasn't this excuse me while I interpret that tongue, just a minute. There wasn't this proliferation of news, right? And so that next day, our home became this gathering place of people throughout the neighborhood. My parents, of course, were there, and our friends and our neighbors, and there was literally weeping and gnashing of teeth as people were distraught over the hope that seemed to be just obliterated in the assassination of this man that was seeking to unify this nation. And as I watched as a 10-year-old kid, as I looked at all this emotion happening and the tears flowing and the angry words, I was confused. No one took me aside and said, hey, you know, this is what's happening and here's why we're so upset. I had to try to figure it out. And so the best thing that I can do is figure out that they killed this man named Martin Luther King because he was black, and they were white, and they killed him because he was black. That's all I can figure out. And I remember leaving our home and walking across the little open area and the little projects that we lived in and walking towards our family car. And I got right in front of our family car, and I literally lifted up my hands and put them in front of my face, and I looked at my hands and I said, I'm black. And if they killed him because he's black, what are they going to do to me? And maybe not totally consciously, but that day I began to behave in such a way that I would escape being killed. I told myself I was going to be good. Not only good, I was going to be better. I was going to be smarter. I was going to be more witty. Now, I don't know that all this was totally, but I know I made up my mind that day that I wasn't going to be killed because of the color of my skin. And how many of you know that God is a God of redemption? That God took that tumultuous time in my life, and as I went through life, and by the way, my plan didn't work really good. I mean, granted, I'm alive. Don't get me wrong. It worked good enough, right? What I realized I was trying to do was assimilate into a society and a culture, and I left behind who I was. But as I began to recapture who I was, God showed me something about my adventure that God revealed to me in part who I was, a bridge builder, that I can find myself in a variety of environments with a variety of folks. And with the ability to connect and to relate and to understand empathetically what it is to be in someone else's skin, I began to understand. And God launched this life work in me to be a bridge builder, because where there is a chasm, it needs a bridge. And everywhere you see a bridge, it's only because there is a chasm. And the chasm is not out of our abundance. The chasm is out of our lack and out of our need. So I want to focus this the rest of our time this morning on what it means to be a bridge builder. Because here's what I know. Bridge building is not an option. It's exactly the work of Jesus Christ on the cross. The chasm was a chasm of sin that separated us from eternity, from our Maker, from our Father. And Jesus, with his work on the cross, bridged the divide of sin that we might have access to the Father. The Bible calls it reconciliation. That's what he gave us. And then the Bible says that he gave to us the ministry and the message of reconciliation. It means he gave us the mission of bridge building. So we're going to talk for the rest of our time this morning about what it means to be bridge builders. And the first aspect of that is bridge builders connect. Bridge builders connect. You know, sameness is safe and difference is difficult. And so if we're not careful, we will just cloister because that is comfortable. But the fact is, there's a disconnection with that. When we purpose to come together as a multi-ethnic community, that we need to know this, that I am incomplete without you. And you are incomplete without me. We can't get to know everybody in the church, but we need to understand that principle, that God brought us together to connect in deep and meaningful ways. And so bridge builders connect. They know that there's something on the other side of that chasm worth connecting with. They know that there's something on the other side of that chasm that's valuable and needs to be reached. And they understand that their life is not fulfilled and total unless they can get to the other side of that chasm. I always marvel at bridge builders. Who was the first person that stood on one side and said, I wonder what's on the other side? And got with the group of folks and built enough interest to say, I don't know what it is, but I know it's worth getting to, so let's build the bridge. How much more should the people of God be compelled to wonder what's on the other side of experience and perspective, and can we build a bridge to meet it? So bridge builders connect. Doesn't that sound sort of elementary with the people of God? That he built us to connect one with another? And if it was that simple, why are less than 3% of the churches, according to the statisticians, why are less than 3% of the churches like Fellowship Monrovia? So to some extent, you might think, hey, Pastor, you're preaching to the choir. We're already multi-ethnic. No, we come together for the sake of the occasion, and for the sake of the patriarch. And now that we're here, how do we live out community? Well, understand the first thing is we're all bridge builders, and bridge builders connect. The second thing is bridge builders span divides. So bridge builders identify and they span divides. See, among bridge builders, divides are unacceptable. I think if I was a literal bridge builder, I'd probably drive past every physical divide and say, how can we put a bridge there to get this group with that group? How can we do something to make sure that that divide doesn't stay? But there's something particular when you're in a multi-ethnic environment. There's a particular divide that is insidious. Not necessarily ill-intended, but it's insidious. It's this thing called stereotypes, right? Stereotypes. So stereotype, stereo meaning multiple type, this idea of an idea or a thought that you superimpose on everyone that tends to sort of be in that group. It's called stereotypes. And then we think about entire groups based on that one idea, if you will. It's called stereotyping. And no one, I don't care who you are, nobody likes that because we're all individuals. It's like saying that me and you eat the same food, like the same music, dress the same way, go to the same barber. Well, we might go to the same barber because you kind of look like. He's black, by the way, so if y'all didn't know what was going on right there. But that's the wrong assumption that we make. I remember years ago when our youngest daughter was just an infant, and we lived in a brand new condominium in a gated community. that happened to be right smack dab in the middle of the hood. I mean, it was right in the hood. Now, I'm not going to say the name of the place, because if I say it, I know some of y'all might live there right now, and you might say, man, that ain't the hood. No, 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 it's the hood. You know, don't get it twisted. It was right. It was like, you know, on 4th of July and New Year's Eve, we slept on the floor, right? All the gunfire going on. We slept on the floor. Some of y'all shaking your head. You know what I'm talking about. So here we are in this gated community in the midst of this challenging neighborhood. And one of the things you always did at night before you went to bed is you made real sure that the doors were locked and the windows were secure. I'm talking about turning the doorknobs, putting your foot up on the jamb, and pulling it, making sure, because you didn't want anybody coming in your house, because it's just as likely that might happen. And so one night, our infant woke up, and she decided it was time to eat, and me being a dutiful husband told my wife, I'll go down and take care of the bottle. I got this. So I get up in the middle of the night, and I make my way towards the stairs. It was a two-story condo. We had a little loft. Stairs were to the right. And as I came across the loft going towards the stairs, I noticed something. I noticed that the sliding glass door was open. I noticed it was open because the curtains were blowing. And I thought, doggone. I know I don't leave anything open in this house. Every night before we go to bed, I'm doing my, you know, making sure. So I look down and I'm perched over the railing on the loft. And the window and the curtain's blowing. Then I start hearing noises. Yeah, it's just like, I'm like, oh, ooh, I think somebody's in my house. So I go back to my room and I tell my wife, I said, honey, somebody's in our house. I said, get all the kids, bring them all into one room and lock the door and call Bob. And Bob was my brother-in-law, is my brother-in-law, and Bob and my wife's sister, Tina, lived directly in front of us in a condo facing. And I don't know why I didn't tell her to call the police. I said, call Bob. Right? So she did. She called Bob, and Bob called the sheriff. And the sheriff deputies were there. I mean, they were there in a matter of minutes, literally. They were there. But in the meantime, I'm thinking, somebody's in my house. What am I going to do? So I went back to my room, and this is the mid-80s. And how many of you know that there might have been a material shortage or something? Because, you know, the shorts, right? I mean, they were short, right? So I had these short, I mean, they were shorts, right? These are shorts, right? And a T-shirt, and I'm thinking, what am I going to do? I don't own a firearm. And so I got the iron. I got an iron, and I got a curtain rod. I had an iron and a curtain rod with shorts on. And I'm at the top of the stairs, and by now the sheriff deputies are there, and they're telling me, I can hear the conversation outside, and I can hear my brother-in-law saying, my brother-in-law's in there, and there's somebody else in there with him that don't belong in there. And I can hear the sheriff deputy say, well, what's your brother-in-law's name? And my brother-in-law said, his name is Ed. And then the sheriff said, Ed, said, you got to come down and let us in. I'm thinking, man, what happened to the, you know, kick the door down like you do? What happened to that? You know, because if somebody's down there, it's going to be between me and him, right? But he said, no, man, you got to come down and open the door. So I'm at the top of the, and I'm literally rocking, man. I got an iron, I got a curtain rod, and I got some shorts on. And I'm thinking, you know what? We got, you know, if he's down there, it's going to be me and him. I'm going to press him and hang him up. And so I don't know what came over me, but I don't remember even touching any stairs. I hit the front door, dropped the curtain rod, kept the iron, and I walked and I ran out the door, and I knew I was safe because I felt the cool breeze of the evening caressing my scantily clad body. So I knew I was good. And so all of a sudden, I could hear this voice that sounded like it was a million miles away. It sounded surreal. And the voice was like one crying in the wilderness. And it was saying, that's my brother-in-law. That's my brother-in-law. And I'm thinking, why is Bob saying that? And I opened my eyes to find every deputy's gun trained on my head. Every And they were yelling, too, things like, dropped iron. You know? And then it dawned on me. You see, here's what you need to know about my brother-in-law. My brother-in-law is white. So my white brother-in-law is telling the deputy, my brother-in-law's in there, and somebody else is, too. So who did you expect to run out? They didn't expect to see somebody, you know, shorts and an iron. And I don't look like Bob. So I must be the other guy, right? It's a funny example of the snap judgments and the perspectives that we have when it comes to those that are different. And as much as Bob and I look different, my different brother cried out on my behalf and literally saved my life. Because had he not cried out, that might have been the headline, you know, the that might have been the headline. Oh, you want to know what happened, don't you? So this is a story that's actually out of my hall of shame. Because there was no one in my house. I think what made it worse is the deputy's attempt to console me. He said, well, you know what, Ed? He said, sometimes our minds just run away with us. We hear things that we really don't hear. Nothing to be ashamed of. Happens all the time. Shut up. I got that close to telling a deputy with a gun to shut up. But the point I want to make is that there's a span, there's a divide that bridge builders step in the midst of. And they cover. And they override stereotypes. And they cry out on behalf of the other. That's my brother-in-law. That's my brother-in-law. It would have been a tragedy if Bob would have said, dude, you're on your own, man. You know? But he didn't. The third thing is bridge builders create access. Isn't this cool? Who doesn't want access? Who doesn't want to be included and involved? You see, whenever a bridge goes up, it immediately allows the traffic to go both ways from both sides, making the unaccessible accessible. Without access, there can be no exchange, whether it's commerce or increase or growth. There can be no exchange if there's no access. So this idea of whatever you have an abundance of or whatever you are in lack of, whatever that dynamic is, exchange can't happen unless there is access, and access can't happen unless bridges are being built. And so we need bridge builders. You know, we have mentor couples, and we have couples that want to be mentored. It's a beautiful picture of this idea of the bridge and creating access. Because these older couples have this wealth and this abundance of experience, and these younger couples have this wealth of idealism. Married folks know what I'm talking about. But this energy and this newness and this excitement. And I guarantee you, in this mentoring relationships that are going to be established, they will be mutually beneficial. I guarantee you. Whenever my wife and I enter into a relationship where we're mentoring, we hear our advice that we're giving these young couples, and we're reminded of the need to honor and value what we're telling them. And it solidifies our relationship. But bridge builders create access. Because there will continue to be, until Jesus comes, an incompleteness and a need for abundance among the people of God. Number four, bridge builders enhance their surroundings. Bridge builders enhance their surroundings. Don't you all just love looking at bridges? I mean, aren't bridges cool? Wherever you go, a bridge just, I mean, a Golden Gate Bridge, you just, you know, fog is covering half. It just looks cool. That's the same effect when there's bridge building going on in the body of Christ. People notice that. They desire to have access to what's being built. They inquire within. You know, the only way that you won't necessarily enjoy bridges is if you have maybe a fear of heights. I won't ask you who has a fear of heights. I can see by some raised eyebrows that some of y'all have a fear of heights. Several years ago, I'm going to involve my other daughter in a story. We were crossing this very high road in Colorado. It was over the Cherry Creek Reservoir, and it was called the Cherry Creek Dam Road. We just called it the Dam Road. I'm not being inappropriate because it was a damn road, right? So we'd call it the damn road because it was a damn road. So we're on the damn road one day, and the traffic was really slow, which is unusual because it's only two lanes on the damn road and there's no lights. But it was really slow that day, and so we were wondering what was going on. But the traffic was moving, and so what we found out was there was a car that was going really, really slow. I'm talking maybe 5 miles an hour, if that. And people were so frustrated with this car that as soon as they got to the car and they can pass the car, they would pass the car and move on and yell and point with one finger and all that kind of stuff, you know. And so then it came my turn to pass, you know, and I passed. But, you know, when something like that happens, you want to see what they look like, don't you? Isn't that weird? You want to, what you look like? Driving all slow. What's wrong with you? You know? So I did. I pulled over and I didn't yell. But I wanted to see what you look like. I looked and there was a lady in this car. And I am not kidding you. She was as white as a sheet. And she had a grip on that steering wheel that if she could have busted it in two, she would have. Her knuckles were, I mean, she was just petrified. Overcome with something, but she wasn't moving. And so I pulled over right in front of her, stopped my car, got out, engaged her, and I said, what's wrong with you? I didn't say it like that, but I was like, ma'am, is there a problem? And she said, I have a fear of heights. I don't know what I was thinking. I was late getting to somewhere, and I thought this might be a faster way. She said, but I can't do it. So I said, here's what you do, ma'am. I said, I'm going to get back in my car. I want you to look at my bumper. Just look at the bumper of my car. Don't worry about anything else. We don't need to go fast. But I'm going to get you off this damn road. Because it was called the damn road. And so I went in my car, got in. I was with my oldest daughter. She's sitting in the passenger seat. And so we started driving. And for maybe a half a minute, she was moving with me. And she stopped again. And she said, I can't do it. I can't go. I'm like, man, we got to do something. Got to happen, you know. And so I went back to my car, and I asked my daughter. I said, I think you're going to have to drive this woman's car. My daughter was 15 years old, and I had just started teaching her how to drive. But we ain't going nowhere unless we can get this woman off this damn road. So I go back, and I start. And this woman, she had a death grip on the steering wheel. It was life and death, literally. So I said, ma'am, listen, this is what we're going to do. I said, my daughter's in the other car. She's going to come over. Man, as soon as I said that, a woman was in the passenger seat so fast, you wouldn't believe it. I mean, she let go of that wheel. She scooted over. She's like, shoot, put her over here. You know, get her in here. And so my 15-year-old daughter comes, and I said, honey, just all you got to do is just go straight. Just go straight. We get to the other side, pull off. And so we did that. See, there was a huge, huge divide. There was a tremendous lack. It had to do with anxiety and fear. Right? And what bridge builders do when that's happening, you step into the midst of it. I'm being a bit metaphoric here, but please track with me. And my daughter, that even though she didn't have all the skill required, her response wasn't, well, you know, I don't have a license. And by the way, I wasn't about to let her drive my car, and I drive a woman's car, right? But see, when people see that happening in a sincere way, because I can guarantee you, there wasn't this sense of sort of, you know, benevolent humanitarianism happening with my daughter right now. She wasn't, well, let me go, you know, help this woman in distress. I mean, she was concerned too, because bridge building is hard. I don't altogether know what I'm doing. I just know that what needs to be done is called for in this minute, and I need to respond. You know, I'm worried about us sometimes when we do our missionary work, where we fly into underprivileged areas, and we give our service. We have this, what I call benevolent humanitarianism, where I'm going to go help someone that is less than me, but there is really no concept of having an exchange or mutual beneficial interaction. So at APU, we have lots of students, to the praise and glory of God, that take missions trips every year. Hundreds, if not thousands, of students go abroad for a variety of purposes. They're about to head out to Mexico in just a few days. And all the ones that I get to talk to, I will tell them about the reciprocation of cross-cultural experiences. Don't have this idea that your gift to God in life is to go and spend a week or two helping someone that doesn't have what you have, and that's the extent of it, because it's not. Because whoever it is that has that lack is made in the image of God. And guess what? They got some abundance. And you got some lack. And so be open to receiving that. And if you find yourself on the damn road, then pray that somebody come help you. Bridge building is hard work. Bridge building is hard work. The Golden Gate Bridge took about 4 years to build, cost over $1 billion. And 11 people lost their lives building the Golden Gate Bridge. It's just one bridge story. There's thousands of bridge stories. The difficulty is they're being built because there's something that was previously impassable that needed a bridge to increase connection and access and enhance the surroundings. And for us, bridge building is hard because of the uncertainty, because of the risk, because of the perceived skill that we need. But I'm sure that someone stood on the San Francisco side of that bridge and looked over towards the Sausalito side and said, you know what? We could really increase access. We could really build community if we were to span this chasm. And keep in mind, the chasm is never based on abundance. It's always based on lack. What lacked at that time is connectivity. So are we standing on the shore of somebody else's life? Are we looking across a relational bridge that might have been there once but has been damaged because of insensitivity or because of misunderstanding or because I see the world going clockwise and you see it going counterclockwise? I believe CNN is telling the truth. I believe Fox News is telling the truth. Now, I know who's telling the truth, but I ain't going to tell the truth. I'm going to leave it to you. Are we willing to stand on the shore of that uncertainty, seeing this chasm, seeing this troubled water, and be satisfied with more than just coming together as the occasion requires and as the patriarch desires? Or are we willing to do the hard work? You see, there's a so that to this. There's a reason for this. Because I believe it's the most pure expression of God's love for people when the people of God behave in the way that God desires us to behave. I think there's a waiting, watching world looking for real dynamic examples of what Christian love looks like in this multi-ethnic expression called Fellowship Monrovia. But it's hard. The final point in being a bridge builder is you don't have to be an expert to be a bridge builder. You don't have to be an expert. John Roebling is a name that may or may not be familiar to you, but he was the architect, the designer and the architect of the first suspension bridge over the Niagara River near the Niagara Falls. So most of you have some picture of how ferocious that river and that falls is. And this is a suspension bridge, so they didn't put any pylons down in the body of the water. They had to suspend this thing across this divide. What's interesting about Roebling is that Roebling wasn't a professional bridge builder. He had never built a bridge. There probably was more than a dozen competitors that bid on the job, and none of them got it, but Roebling got the job. And Roebling didn't get the job because he understood how to build bridges. Roebling got the job because he understood the divide. He was an expert in water. He built aqueducts and canals, and he understood currents, and he understood everything about the divide. He understood it so well that they trusted him to do something he had never done before. And now he was an engineer. Don't get me wrong. He wasn't like a supermarket clerk that just said, give me a shot, right? Everybody need a shot. How you going to get credit if you ain't got credit? Got to give me some credit first. But he had never built a bridge, but they trusted him. And he built the first ever suspension bridge across the Niagara River near the Niagara Falls. But it's because he knew and understood, and it was an expert on the divide. So there are many of us, even this morning, thinking, I don't know how to do what you're saying. You don't have to know how to do what I'm saying. You just have to understand and know that there's a divide. And you have to be convinced that there's a divide. You have to push past the tendency to say that just because we are all here, that we've somehow pushed past the divide. To the praise and glory of God, there's hard work still to do. And God is equipping us to do it. There's a song that I've been fond of for a long time. It's by a guy by the name of Brian Duncan. Anybody heard of Brian Duncan, Sweet Comfort Band? A few hands raise up. The song is called We All Need. We All Need. Remember, if you don't take anything else away from this morning, is that the divide is not based on our abundance. The divide is based on our need. And this song says we all need, and if you allow me, I just want to read the words to you. He starts out and he says, from a cardboard hovel in a darkened street to the well-lit windows of a penthouse suite, all are desperate souls of the human race, of the human fate, and we protect ourselves within the walls we make. And I stand here now in my house of rest, and I bow my head and I beat my breast, and I say, God, please forgive me for this sinner's heart. Though you show me your mercy, it's the same old story keeping us apart. And the chorus says, and we all feel lost sometime, and we all feel hurt inside, and we all cry, and we all need the redeeming love of Jesus. And I was raised on the lessons of the victory speech, and I fought for the standards that I could not reach. And I hold my tongue when the pain is great, and I cover my tears as we celebrate. While a private war rages with the fear and the doubt as I try to run faster to find my way out, because I'm convinced if I stumble that they'll cast me aside, mock at my weakness and shatter my pride, because I've watched as they've stoned the more hesitant soul. But we still must remember it's God's grace we need to know, because we all feel lost sometimes. We all feel hurt inside, and we all cry, we all need the redeeming love of Jesus. I wonder what it would be like if we allowed our perspective to change just a little bit. And if someone we know, their world spins counterclockwise versus clockwise, and we realize that we're not complete in and of ourselves, I wonder what it would look like for us to inquire based on our need, seeking to understand before being understood. God is doing an amazing work at Fellowship Monrovia, and it has more to do with the composition of folk that's showing up. It has to do with the love of it being expressed from Almighty God. We're going to close this morning with a song. It's a powerful song, and the way we're going to close it is that we're all going to stand in a moment, and as is our tradition at Fellowship Monrovia, we build bridges, don't we? We span the aisles, and we grab a hand, and we show our connection and our commitment in doing so. And so as Tanya leads us in this next song, I'm going to invite you all to stand and grab a hand and sing along with this song.